is an important element to it. In other words, the struggle is not only a saying no in opposition, but it's also a moment of transformation, a collective transformation, individual and collective transformation. I think that this has been one of the important contributions of the feminist movement to the process of anti-capitalist struggle, really transforming the conception of what it means to organize them. And that the struggle has to have a healing, transformative dimension. So the struggle of our bodies has been really a struggle that has changed profoundly our theories and our practice. At the same time, through this struggle, we have also learned, we have also understood that we need to go beyond the body itself. That as much as important it is, you know, to change our bodies, we cannot achieve our objective unless we change the material conditions of our life. And this will be one of the points that we'll be discussing. Unless we need to go beyond a logic of a society like capitalism that is built on the exploitation of human bodies, the exploitation of human labor, and the private accumulation of wealth. And so in a sense, the struggle over the body has to be understood as a struggle that opened the door, right, to a whole range of struggle. Opens the door to a whole range of struggle. And here I want to mention something, a contribution that comes to this vision, you know, from the feminist movement of indigenous community, particularly in Latin America, where women have developed the concept of the body as my territory. And a concept, the body as a territory that has a double implication. On one side, the defense of the body is crucial to the defense of the territory. So that the concept of the defense of the body has played a huge role in the struggle, for example, against feminicide. But at the same time also, right, it has meant to recognize that we cannot reclaim our body unless, in a way, we also reclaim, for instance, the land, our contact with the land, our relationship with the land, right? In other words, that for our body to be able to exist, you know, they have to have a place. For our body to be able to thrive, they have to have this connection to the land, that there is a continuity, a necessary continuity that in capitalism is continuously broken, in the same way as the cycles of nature are broken, like by the commodification, you know, of land, the commodification of its product. And so the idea of the body as territory is an idea that has inspired much poetry. Yes? Oh, 5 minutes. Oh my God. I knew that this would happen. But I have to quickly, I do still have 5 minutes?
You still have five
okay.
minutes, yes.
But now
so
I
we
lost
can talk
my...
about everything you don't yes. manage now, we'll manage in the conversation.
Oh, okay. I'll quickly read this, and I hope in 5 minutes I'll do speed reading. Yeah, the concept of the body as territory to be defended inspired the creation of effective practices like dancing, playing, hugging, loving, as ritual that subvert, problematize, activate. As described by the Guatemaltecan feminist Lorena Cabral, the struggle over the body is necessarily connected to the struggle over the land, because it is impossible to conceive of our bodies without a place, a locality, a space that gives meaning to our existence. So strong is the relation between body and land among indigenous people of America that in parts of Mexico, women, when they give birth, bury in the land their placenta as a commitment to defend the land and not to allow oblivion to set in. It is precisely to break this tie to the land that the Mexican government has recently forbidden women to give birth at home, has forced them to go to the hospital. So the women now must hide their pregnancies while all along fearing criminalization. Bearing the placenta into the land is a symbolic gesture recognizing that our bodies in themselves are not complete. They are not self-subsistence, but they live and have meaning only to the extent that they are part of a broader reality. And of course, we know all pre-capitalist society have known that our bodies are not contained and limited by the outlines of our skin. In Aboriginal cultures, bodies are inhabit a liminal place where humans meet the non-human realm, the world of animals, the world of spirits and soul. It was believed, for example, that the ability to move between these states was a requirement for health and healing. In European pre-capitalist society as well, the body was seen as a continuum, as I mentioned before, with the celestial world. And the body is being seen as a sphere of relation that connects us to other people. And this is what I think, to shorten, we have to reclaim, you know. And because in order to be struggle against this great monster that is capitalist society, we need to go beyond all the ways in which capitalism has isolated us from each other and the way in which it has individualized our life and reconnect us not only to other people, but also to other people who are living today, but also to the dead, also to those, you know, who we can consider as our ancestors. And this, again, is a theme that comes very strongly, very powerfully, you know, from indigenous feminist, you know, movement, right? That our solidarity, our corporeal solidarity has to be exercised not only with the living, but also with the dead. And so in a way that, you know, our everyday relation to our body becomes the energy, the principle for the creation of a broad commons and the construction of new communal relation. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Sylvia, I'm going to pick up on the point you made in the end. I know we discussed before many topics that we wanted to talk about, and I'm going to start now from this, almost from your conclusion, where there's this idea that the body has to be understood as part of the commons. And I told you already when we were preparing this conversation that I find the commons a very challenging topic for people living under late capitalism.
Yeah.
People like myself who live in an urban environment, possess mm-hmm. nothing except our useless gadgets, don't even live in the place where they were born, so also that connection to the land is yeah. broken. How can we understand the commons in a way that speaks to people like me, and I imagine many people in the audience who have lost that more direct connection yeah. that you see in indigenous communities?
Yeah, they say, you know, the commons is a big discourse. And, you know, we were discussing before about the fact that there's often a very limited conception of what we mean by commons. By the way, commons is the English world. It's a very, very often commons are identified a specific material reality. So the first thing that comes to people's mind would be like urban gardens. You know, urban gardens, everybody works collectively, right? Or, you know, some of the fields in the Middle Ages, you know, certainly in England, but I think across Europe, often the landlords, you know, who give the serf, the people living, you know, on their lands, they would give them some land from their reproduction, and their land was cultivated communally. Often the landlords contracted, so to speak, a whole village. And then they decided, you know, when to sow, when to harvest, and they would have assemblies, and decisions were made collectively. You know, what are we going to do with this land, and so on. So the idea that the commons are material reality is very deep, and I think it's very powerful. This, you know, because we cannot have a communal life unless we have a material basis of existence. So the issue of land is fundamental. At the same time, I think it's most useful to think of commons today in our struggle as a general principle of social organization, not as a set of things. No, the things may be the realization of that principle, right? Not the concrete realities may be the realization of the principle, but to think of commons. So we have society organized according, you know, to a market principle, to a capitalist principle, right? Well, society is organized according to the principle of commons, generally. You know, there is a powerful book by Massimo De Angeli called Omnia Sunt Communia, and who makes that point. And when you think of the commons that way, then in a sense you are not tied to a land base. Then you can think of the commons in every sphere of life. Then you can think of commons in terms of knowledge. What does it mean to build communal forms of knowledge, commons of knowledge? What does it mean to take knowledge out of the market? Right? Completely think of not now. For example, I come from the United States now, which is the top society, you know, not surprisingly, I mean, the leading capitalist country in the world. But in order, for example, to go to a university, you now have to make yourself you have to work 24 hours a day to be able to pay the fees. So this idea, which was an abomination to pre-capitalist society, the knowledge can be an item of marketing, can be acquired or sold for money, right? But so commons of knowledge. I was saying before that, for instance, you know, we can think of commoning in relation to the organization of justice. You know, in the United States, we have an abolition, a very powerful abolitionist movement that is struggling for the abolition of jails, the abolition as it should be, and the abolition of the police, which is really, you know, everybody now, well, many in the different movement speak of the police as an occupation force, and so the question comes, well, how do you organize, right? How do you guarantee the safety of our community? And so here too, the inspiration comes often from the experience of indigenous people, you know, who didn't know about jails, right? But in fact, they had forms of justice that were restorative, that were not so much concerned with punishment, but they were concerned with, you know, healing the society and attempting to recuperate those who acted in a way that was antisocial, right? And in a way, basically saw justice, basically organized in forms that would not break the communal bonds, right? So the idea is of a justice that is organized communally, that is not imposed like from an alien force or from the state as it is now, but is actually organized. So this is what I mean, the principle of the commons, that not be limited to, you know, our conception of, you know, material goods, material realities that we share, you know, that we benefit from, you know, but also, again, as a principle that we can think of applying to every aspect of our life, you know, and also in terms of the land, right, the commons, important to underline, should not be seen as a kind of free-for-all, you know, as, okay, having land and having from which we can take with full hands, but rather as a principle of organization that recognize not only interdependence, but reciprocity, you know, so that if we take from the land, we also have to give back to the land. So that the commoners is not only the person who takes from the land, but also the person who cares for the land, ensures that the land, or whatever other goods we share, you know, is available, as the indigenous people say, for the next seven generations, right? So this, I think, is the principle that we must work with. Mm. And of course, it's an open-ended concept. Because we are not, when we speak of commons, we can be inspired by the past, but there's no return to the past. Mm-hmm. We are not thinking of returning to the past. It's inspired by the past, but to think the new forms that are now, you know, necessary, you know, for a changed reality.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You're already here talking about something that you mentioned in your lecture right now that I also want to pick up, which is this, not only the resistance, but the creation of something new, imagining something new, working towards something new. And one of the points that I found very interesting in the talk and in the conversation we had before is also focusing on the joyfulness of of resistance. You know, the effective practices around it, like dancing, playing, hugging, laughing, all of this is also part of resistance. Can you tell us more about what you see in this joyfulness that for you has to do with resistance, actually?
Yes, I think that I was saying before that feminist movement has made an important contribution in terms of theory, but also and not only in terms of you know, opening up new areas of struggle, but also transforming the concept, you know, of how we organize ourselves, you know, on the forms of organization. And I think this is because many of us, especially in the 70s, came from the experience of being militant in a male-dominated organization, you know, where the kind of work, the form of organizing, you know, almost had a factory-like quality, you know, to the point that, you know, making a struggle begins dangerously to look like alienated labor, you know, where the point in which you have, you know, the discipline and, you know, to the point where one more meeting, the burden of the meeting is not something you're looking forward to see, right, as something that is life-changing and life-improving, but another piece of work, right, another piece of work, which leads you to understand why many people do not join this organization, but rather at the end of a tiring day would rather go and watch a movie or watch a football game, because otherwise this sense of a burden. So the idea instead, right, which is not easy to accomplish, but I think has to be pursued, you know, a form of organizing that are constructive, transformative, in which, in a way, we begin to create, that are creative of the elements of the society that we want to build, right? Of the society of that we want to build. In other words, you know, that's what I spoke about, joyful militance. Joyful militance is like a principle that will say, if you're really bored by another meeting, if you're really bored by the work that you do in your organizing, perhaps there's something wrong. Perhaps you should reconsider what you're doing. Because the struggle, if a struggle that you engage in is not beginning to deal, to respond to the misery that we live in our day, in our everyday life, then why struggle? Mm. Unless, in a sense, cannot build a change in our life, so that we may want to go to a meeting, and want to go to a meeting because you're meeting people with whom you have now a whole relation, because they are part of your life, because their existence becomes meaningful to you. And this is where the affective ties. And this is where, you know, the practices that are creating the affective ties. You know, we've had long discussion, and I'm thinking here of a group of women that has been very inspirational to me. It's a group of domestic workers in Spain called Territorio Domestico, Territorio Domestico Activo. And these were all domestic workers, you can imagine, many coming from Africa, from Latin America, from the Philippines. So you know what kind of life they would have, underpaid, away from their families, often away from their children, with all kinds of problems, you know, dealing one-to-one relationship in these families, often abused, you know, so a life of misery. And then you organize, and then they realized that unless the organizing was giving them pleasure, they were giving them some life, you know, they would not be able to continue to do it. They would not be able to attract more women. And so they made a key point that a part of the time of their coming together, despite the lack of time, you know, had to be spent dancing, cooking together, singing, making song. They decided that part of their work had to do making song, making food, dancing, learning to know each other. It couldn't be only making posters and being in the street and singing, you know, and screaming slogan and et cetera, et cetera. And this is what I mean, you know. So, you know, I've come to say and see that when we speak of commons, communal relations, right, we should not speak of commons only as an objective to be achieved by our struggle. These objectives that somehow they seem to continuously be projected further and further away from us. But we should think of commons, communal relations, as the condition for our struggle. Right? The creating of relationships that connect us, that make us share our life, as a condition to be able to struggle. Struggles have to be produced. Struggles have to be supported. They have to be sustained. They do not come automatically because you are enraged. You know, rage and opposition will take you to the street, will have the great demonstration, the great moment of no saying, of saying no. But then the moment collapses, and we have seen so many times powerful struggles collapsing. And then you say, what happened? And so we are talking about making struggle sustainable and commons as a condition of struggle. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Let me pick up on
and the struggle as joy giving, as a healing. As a healing practice, as a moment, yeah. And the beginning of a construction of a new society. The new society, Marx was right in this, right? The saying that communism, you know, is not something projected in the future, but is the process by which on a day-to-day basis you transform your everyday reality.
Mm-hmm. I want to focus, based on that, on an issue that shows the complexities of the struggle within the ongoing capitalist system, because I think this is the the difficulty a lot of us have is having these visions for a future that we want to build, and yet being stuck within capitalist structures. And when you talked about this example of domestic laborers, many of them illegal, working, you know, to for their rights, to fight for their rights with joy. I was thinking of something that I also mentioned to you before, about this example of precisely these women who leave what are fundamentally also violent patriarchal societies where femicides are very present, like you know, Mexico, Argentina, coming to Europe, hoping for more opportunities, hoping for the opportunity to liberate themselves from these patriarchal shackles, and then seeing that the only possibility they have to make a living is within illegal domestic labor, for example. And this is a widespread phenomenon also here in Switzerland, where you have so much care work being done by migrants, so much care work being done by illegal migrants, or migrants who have been illegalized, let's put it this way, because nobody is legal or illegal. My question would be, how can feminists address these important issues of global inequality when they are not part of that experience, and yet they want to connect, they want to create this common struggle? What would be your advice based on the years and years and years of experience you've had? How do we connect these worlds?
Well, it's crucial. I think, my God, we cannot have, you know, a feminist struggle unless at the center of it is the question of solidarity and commonality, you know, with the struggle of immigrant women who have been forced to leave their country and come and work as domestic workers. I think the struggle of domestic workers in Europe, in the United States, everywhere, has to be central, fundamental, because the devaluation and the abusive condition in which domestic workers, you know, who basically are the product of the restructuring of the global economy, they are the product, you know, of the so-called debt crisis, which has been artificially created, are the product about globalization, which has been a form of recolonization. And so they've been forced to leave their country. They are not coming and abandoning the families and relation for the sake of a new world, but because they have no chances of guaranteeing a future to children and communities unless they migrate. And so in a way they are following their money. In a way they are following the money that is being expropriated through the structural adjustment programs, you know, from so much of the so-called third world. So I think that those struggles and the devaluation and abuses, the domestic workers, migrant domestic workers, you know, are suffering, you know, are very much rooted in the general devaluation of reproductive work. So accepting or reinforcing, you know, the way the state abuses, you know, migrant domestic worker or migrant worker in general, you know, it's a way of, you know, perpetuating the devaluation of our own life, the devaluation of reproductive work, which is really the devaluation of our life, because when you devalue the activities by which our lives is reproduced, you also devalue our lives. So I think the key central to feminist struggle has to be the solidarity and the commoning of struggle between, you know, so-called native women, I don't know how many are natives, and women who are migrant. No, so this whole division has been part of the restructuring that we define as globalization of the global economy, as restructure reproductive work as well. So that, you know, women in Europe, or part of women in Europe, in the US, in other so-called developed countries, have finally entered wage labor. We usually at the lowest level, right? Always in condition of precarity and low pay, and often, you know, unsanitary condition, but enter wage labor, and of course their place has been not taken by the domestic workers coming from the third world. So this, I think,